Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. In the first hour today, we will be talking about the Rural Studio. This is a program that was founded in 1993 at Alabama's Auburn University at the Architecture School, and was founded there to give students some hands-on experience while at the same time providing inexpensive housing for people who live in one of the poorest parts of America. Our guest for this hour of the show is Andrew Freer. He's director of the studio. In addition to building single-family homes, students involved in the Rural Studio have built churches and community centers and playgrounds, demonstrating that functional and attractive buildings can be constructed on a very tight budget. And we'll find out more about the studio as we talk in this part of the show with Andrew Freer. He grew up in England, in Yorkshire. He's associate professor at Auburn, associate professor of architecture. He was educated at the Polytechnic of Central London and also the Architectural Association of London. He's practiced in London and Chicago and taught design studio for 5 years at University of Illinois at Chicago. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and questions, of course, are welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, be a part of the conversation, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number and we'll pay for the call. That is 800-222-9455. So again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, certainly, if you have questions, you are welcome to call. Professor Freer, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, no problem.
We appreciate it.
The invitation.
Let's start out. I'll start out by giving you the opportunity to talk a little bit more generally about the program, about the Rural Studio, and what it's all about.
Okay. Well, as you suggested in your introduction, it was established some 14 years ago by Samuel Mockbee and D.K. Ruth. They actually, the program itself is actually 3 hours away from the university. We're 3 hours west of the university, essentially in the middle of nowhere, quite close to the civil rights triangle of Birmingham, Selma, and Montgomery. We're on the western edge of that. And we take about 30 to 35 students every year. We have the youngest are second-year students and the oldest are fifth-year students. And they get quite remarkable hands-on experience. They get to immerse themselves in a small rural community, to learn the sorts of arts and crafts tradition and hands-on making experience of architecture. And they also get to work in teams, which not many people at architecture school necessarily have a great deal of experience of. Typically, you're always a sort of individual tortured artist. So they, the second years typically will build a charity house, which takes about a year, and the thesis students, the fifth years, come out here and they build larger community projects. At the moment, we're working on a 40-acre park, which is the largest park in West Alabama. We've just finished a small courtyard for the hospital, and this last Saturday we had an opening for the Hale County Animal Shelter, and I think this last year we've served more people in West Alabama than we've served in all of our previous projects put together. So that's what we do. The students design, build, construct, raise money, write grants, talk to subcontractors, dig trenches, put the electric in, do the plumbing. They do the whole kit and caboodle, whole community meetings. You name it, they do it. And it's sort of a remarkable opportunity for them. So.
Hmm. Are there many other programs like this for architecture students?
There are a number of smaller ones. There's one in Seattle, Washington, run by Steve Bedanes, which is that our isolation out here allows us to do much larger and more significant projects than perhaps other programs that exist. There are certainly an awful lot, quite a lot of building programs in the different schools, but typically they'll take on relatively less ambitious projects like small single freestanding houses. So this program, I would suggest, with its sort of raw ambition and opportunity, is sort of operating in a different realm to most of the others. That's fair to say, and it's simply a situation that's offered by its isolation and the need out here. We really almost have become the sort of West Alabama architect and builder, quite honestly. There's not anybody else doing the amount and quantity and quality of work that we're doing out here, and you know, we're not taking food off the table of builders and architects, because they don't exist out here. So we invent the project and find the money for the project and find the need for the project. And so, you know, what it does is, it's nice because very often we actually are allowed sort of doing big enough projects that we can engage subcontractors. So we're putting I think we figured it out that we're putting between $2 and $3 million a year into West Alabama just through, you know, the types of work that we're doing, the investment, and, you know, day-to-day living. When you have 35 to 40 people, they tend to spend quite a lot of money at the local gas station. So,
tell us a little bit more about what this part of Alabama is like.
Well, it's this morning I'm actually sitting in New Bern. I'm talking to you from New Bern, which is a small town of 200 people. It's in the county of Hale County. Hale County is the second poorest county in the second poorest state. It has a population of about 16,000. 36% of that population are below the poverty line, and about 45% of the kids under the age of 4 are below the poverty line. So it's a poor place. Predominantly relies on farming. There is some logging goes on, but most of the hardwoods have disappeared. A lot of the land is owned by newspaper industry. So there's quite a substantial amount of softwood logging. And then the other thing is dairy farming and catfish. The local farmers, who are very hardworking, have diversified into catfish farming. And ironically enough, the same red clay that propagated cotton is expansive clay. And if you dig a hole in the red clay, it holds water very well. And so there's an abundance of catfish farms down here at the moment. But even that industry, I believe, is struggling because there's not enough demand for catfish at the moment. So it's a beautiful green rolling landscape. The scale of it changes, and the type of landscape changes very quickly from relatively flat to rolling hills to trees to rivers, and very beautiful. For an English person, it's actually relatively English-looking landscape, if you like.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Andrew Freer. He is associate professor in the School of Architecture at Auburn University. That's in Alabama. He's also director of the Rural Studio. And as he explained, this is a program that has now been going for 17 years. 14 years. 1993, that was when the program started, 1993. Yeah. And they do most of their work 3 hours west of the university in a very poor part of the state, which is actually a very poor part of the country. And the idea, as he explained, was both to give students hand-on design-build experience, but also to do something for the community there. And they have been involved in constructing housing and some other kinds of community buildings there. One of the important points is that it's all done on a very, very tight budget. The number here, if you'd like to join us, you have questions or comments or whatever, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, maybe I can give you a chance to amplify on this budget issue. Let us say, for example, you're building a single-family home.
Yeah.
What is your budget now for that?
We can build a 1,000 to 1,500 square foot single family house for between $20,000 and $25,000 in materials. Our projects are not cheap. Our students are actually phenomenally good at getting on the telephone and raising an awful lot of money. They don't know who they shouldn't ask, and they're quite belligerent sometimes in the sort of request that they can make to people. So we get donations of wood, we get donations of tiles, we get donations of carpets. I mean, phenomenal different types of donations from all over the country. People are very generous and often are willing to do it as a tax write-off. So our projects really when I say $20,000 to $25,000, that's simply the raw material. Obviously, our students provide free labor. All of our consultants do the work pro bono. So it's actually kind of difficult to put a figure on the cost of the project. But for between $20,000 and $25,000 in raw materials, we can give you a very nice single family house.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Another example. Just recently, we built a new fire station and town hall for New Bern, and the students raised over $100,000 in materials donations for that project. And this was a young 22-year-old woman who was just incredible on the telephone. I don't know what the heck she promised them, but she was just hell on wheels in terms of being able to raise money and raise donations. So. Mm-hmm. They don't know what they shouldn't promise and who they shouldn't ask.
So if one asks the question, if you had to, still there, Andrew?
Yes.
Oh, okay. If one asks the question, if you had to pay full price for your materials and you had to pay for your labor, mm-hmm. would you even hazard a guess at what one of these houses would cost?
Oh, I mean, it's up into the hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, it's. We're very well known for doing cheap housing you can call it affordable, you can call it economic, you can call it. I mean, we recycle an awful lot, and it becomes cheap because, of course, we recycle. But if you can't, you know. I mean, it's wrong to say that people's labor should be free, and that, you know, so the amount of time. I mean, the students put just really quite insane amounts of hours into what they do because they love doing it. We completed an animal shelter this last weekend, and it was a 5,000 square foot building. Which will shelter approximately 20 dogs and a whole bunch of cats, and it has two conditioned spaces in it, and it's a phenomenal thing. And the students graduated a year and a half ago, and they stayed here a year and a half on their own dollar, buying their own gasoline and their own food, and surviving out here to finish this project. And you know, the level of commitment the students show to do these things is just outrageous.
Mm.
It's very hard to put a dollar figure on that kind of commitment and energy and time that they do into these things. So.
Well, we have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? This is someone listening in Champaign on our line number one, right here. Hello.
Hello. It's fascinating, and I commend you and your Auburn architecture students for your work ethic and your ethos in this regard. My question is, since this is such an innovative program, is it unique to Auburn University, or have other universities fought in on this concept. And in your case, what about the University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa?
Well, we're closer to the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa than we are to Auburn. And they unfortunately don't have an architecture department, but a number of their artists and different students do come down here and get involved. As to the question of that, there are certainly other schools of architecture around the country that have much less ambitious programs. That typically they're involved in smaller, simpler housing projects. Probably the truth of the matter is that many academics around the country wouldn't put up with the living conditions that I endure out here. it's a relatively lonely life, and there's no good bars and no good restaurants and all of that stuff that typical smart academics actually enjoy. So I just have the company of a bunch of 22-year-olds who are very entertaining, but occasionally it can be quite lonely. So there are reasons that, you know, I made my bed and I lay in it, but it's sort of an isolated life, and I'm not certain how many academics around the country would be willing to put up with what I put up with. But there's also,
well, we always tout in academia this notion of service as part of the holy trilogy, and what you're doing is surely the embodiment of service. Personified.
Yeah, no, I mean it is. It's. I have to tell you though, I cannot imagine a more rewarding teaching situation. The students come out here to do precisely what they do, to build animal shelters and houses and community centers, and they focus on doing it. And there's very few complications to everyday life. And so they're incredibly focused and incredibly hardworking and resilient, and they truly believe in what they're doing. And so from a teacher's point of view, it's just you have them so totally and utterly focused. It's remarkable. I mean, I think quite honestly, the reason it's succeeded out here is everybody wins. As a student, they get an incredible education. The local community has completely bought into us as neighbors now after 14 years. And as a teacher, it's a phenomenal teaching experience because they don't have any kind of complications of everyday life. There's no traffic jams. You don't have to, you know, spend 3 hours going to the local superstore. Life is very, very simple and very, very focused. And I'm sure something like this could take off in other parts of the country. It's just whether there's the desire. We're very lucky, having sort of endured it for 14 years out here. We've become very much a trusted neighbor and a fixture in the community, and they enjoy us. We're not just a bunch of academics in the middle of the field. We employ, my staff is all local people. We are treated as a neighbor, and, you know, that actually comes a responsibility with that. If we make a mess or we make a mistake, we get to hear about it big time. So,
well, thank you, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's talk with someone else. This is also someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I grew up in Georgia, and I always heard fine things about Auburn's architecture school. In fact, I had a neighbor, an older neighbor, who went to school there. I grew up in the time when girls could not even enter. I don't know about Auburn, but I do know Georgia Tech would not admit women until many years later. But anyway, I wanted to ask, I think your project is just commendable. It sounds like such a wonderful thing to do for the students. I have a son and a daughter who both studied architecture, but they had to go in different angles from that when the economy would wax and wane.
Yeah.
And one of them still freelances buildings in Missouri. But when the students who worked on this project leave, where are they now? And
well, that's a good
what
question.
Are they doing?
Yeah, they the program is 14 years old, and so if they were here as 20 to 22-year-olds, they're now in their mid-30s. And I think, to be quite honest with you, when they're out here, they're so young, they don't have any sense of what the kind of the real architectural world is like. They don't, they're not people who have actually ever been in offices. And so typically what they do when they've finished out here is, of course, they're all stony broke, and they go off and they work in relatively conventional places. But I do know that the folks that were here 14 years ago, a number of them have actually begun to sort of venture off on their own and are not doing what you would call conventional practice. I think they're all quite affected by what they do out here and begin to start to look to do things or begin to sort of establish architectural practices that can help people who are less advantaged than they are, because I think that your typical architect, unfortunately, has to sort. Most architects are working for the rich and the wealthy and the famous. And I think one of the things that we try to encourage is sort of that everybody can have some architecture, and that all buildings can lift the spirit. And it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor; that you can all always expect a building that can have some aspiration and delight. And,
right.
What I'm trying to say is it's. Their career trajectories have been relatively similar to all of their colleagues so far. A number of them have gone off around the world and trying to start looking for alternatives, but I don't think there's enough of a kind of... I think 14 years on, some of them are at a particular age where they can really begin to make some decisions for themselves, but I think it's going to take some time before it has sort of major impacts on the world of architecture.
For a while, I kept reading that the University of Illinois School of Architecture had a project in East St. Louis.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's a continuing thing or not. Anymore.
No, yes, I know it used to. I don't know enough about it. Let me just say one thing about that you were talking about girls being admitted to school and to architecture school. I have to tell you that in my experience in the last 5 years teaching out here and working with students, the women and the girls have been the best students out here. They're the first one in the trench. They're the most organized. They're the smartest. They're the most rigorous. And I've thoroughly enjoyed working with the girls. And we have a pretty much 50-50 acceptance policy out here. So it's really really balanced sex-wise. And the School of Architecture at Auburn is actually getting more women applicants now than male applicants. So that's going to change the architectural world completely, I think, in the future.
Well, I want to thank the caller for her questions, comments. We're at our midpoint here already, and for people who are listening and maybe have just tuned in, I do also want to introduce again our guest, Andrew Freer. He is Associate Professor of Architecture at Auburn University. That's in Alabama. He's also Director of the Rural Studio, and as he explained, this is a program that got going first in 1993, and they do their work actually not at the university but 3 hours west in a part of Alabama that is very poor. The idea here of the program has been to give architecture students hands-on build design experience and at the same time do something for the community. And what they have done over time is they have built a number of homes, single-family homes, and some other kinds of community structures, playgrounds, and so forth. And they do that supplying all of the labor themselves. They get donated materials. A lot of the consultants provide the services for free. And so they're able to build buildings at very low cost, very, you know, interesting, quality, comfortable, functional buildings at very low cost. So at the same time, give the students that experience and also make that contribution to the community. And as he has explained, although there certainly are programs like this at other universities around the country, there's probably nothing else on this scale where the projects are as ambitious as they are here. And questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I think that one of the things that seems to be the case is that it is very difficult to build a home, a house, even a small house that is well-built, comfortable, functional, energy efficient, all of the things that you would really like in a structure. Even a small house, it seems like it's pretty tough to do that for under $100,000. Are there some things that, given that this is a little bit of an unusual situation in that, as you've explained, the students are doing the work and they're not paid, and a lot of the material is donated, so that's why you can build a house for $20,000 to $25,000. Are there, though, do you think, lessons that can be taken from the kind of work that you've done there that can be applied to building elsewhere in perhaps a more conventional way and can address what we know is a real serious need here in all over the United States for affordable housing?
Well, I should quickly mention in the last 3 years, we've actually been building a house called the $20,000 house, which is a house that tries to conform to a rural development loan for $20,000, specifically aimed at the poorest of the poor, and expects them to go and find a builder and use the $20,000 to pay a builder to build them a new home. And one of the things about that loan is that it's kind of an odd catch-22 situation, because the loan exists, but there isn't a rural development-approved model for the $20,000. So people can get the money, but then there's not an approved model for that house. Seems to be a slightly odd thing. And so we found out about this, and in the last 3 years, we've built three $20,000 houses and tried to understand what it is that we can give people for $20,000. And actually what that has meant is building it for $10,000 in materials, with the assumption that the other 10 would go to a builder for his labor and for his profit. And in the last 3 years, we've built anything from a 450 square foot house with two huge porches to an 800 square foot house with a small porch. So they've all been built with 2x6s, stud frame construction, all insulated to the hilt, and all very interesting architecturally. And so they're, you know, what we've been able to do is use the fact that we can afford to experiment, whereas a builder and an architect couldn't, for such a small house, couldn't spend the time and the energy that we can. So we have a kind of a luxurious position to be able to go and test something like this. And what we're hoping is in the next couple of years to, because there's a shortfall of about 15,000 substandard houses in Hale County, and we're hoping that as this house evolves, that we're going to work with some local builders and that they can go off and build these things and employ people to help them build them as well. So hopefully economically we can really have an impact, and also socially with the quality of the housing. So like I say, I think that because we have an opportunity as teachers and as students to explore some things that people in the commercial world can't. And I think there's sort of a duty for us to do that. So, that's an example. In other aspects, we've also looked at doing a number of houses that have had a really strange variety of recycled materials, anything from carpet to tiles, to bales of cardboard, looking for sort of the detritus and leftovers of everyday life to see if we can actually use those to help us build cheaper. And so again, we have an opportunity that nobody else has to explore things like that.
Yeah, just to go back to the very idea of a small house, a house this small. I'm sure that by contemporary standards, even a house of 800 square feet
yeah.
is quite small.
Yeah,
and that some people might have a hard time imagining how one would live in an 800 square foot
yeah.
house.
Yeah, no, I mean there's an American disease of, you know, bigger is better, and you know, my students, I was just talking to a student last night who's just taken a job, and she's building a 14,000 square foot house for a second home at the beach. And that sort of seems slightly excessive and outrageous when you consider when she's out here, she was working on, you know, houses that were 500 to 800 square feet, and I think, you know, the issue is not to say that people can't have more space, but I think most of the time the question should be asked is whether we really truly need it. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to end up conditioning it, whether you have to heat it, and we try not to have to cool our buildings with any kind of electrical appliances. We try to make sure that they're all naturally ventilated because, you know, air conditioning really is not something that's particularly sustainable and will not be in the future. And so we suggest that people we hope people will try to live modestly, that we give them bigger porches, so that the enclosed space, the conditioned space, is relatively small, but perhaps there's been generally generous and bigger porch. That's not to try to say that poor people have to live in small things. It's simply a case of we have a certain amount of money. We'd like to build you something that will last a very long time. I mean, our $20,000 house is competing with a trailer, and when people go and buy trailer homes, the problem is that they buy them on the never-never, and after 25 years, the built-in obsolescence means that the trailer home has fallen to bits after 25 years, so all that money they've paid into it has basically been thrown down the drain, whereas what we're building, I think, can last for 150 years. They're lifted off the ground, they're on good concrete foundations, they're all built with timber that's always bigger than 2x6s, they're very well insulated, and so we hope that we're giving people an investment that will last many lifetimes, not just a single lifetime. You know, that's what I call sustainable. Even for small amounts of money, you should be able to give somebody something that will last a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that there at least is some interest out there in the country
yeah.
in developing smaller homes that will address a variety of needs. The fact that, particularly as people age,
yeah.
they want to scale down. Family sizes are smaller. People are interested in affordability.
Yeah.
They're interested in environmental impact. They're interested in energy efficiency. All those sorts of things.
Yeah.
There seems to be. It seems small, but I think that there are a lot of people who believe that there is a real potential for developing really functional, attractive, well-constructed, energy-efficient, small homes on the order of, I don't know, of 800 square feet. But, you know, the house I live in, I think, is about 1,200, and it seems pretty small to me, so I'm not sure about 800. But, you know, maybe things in that under 2,000 square feet.
I think that we have a responsibility to encourage people to live that way and to give them beautiful spaces. I mean, all of our, where there is some luxury in these houses that we design is in their ceiling heights. Even if you're in a 1,200 square foot or an 800 square foot, if the ceiling's relatively tall, the space can actually feel bigger. And, you know, I think your point about the changing demographic is very important. Our latest little house is actually It's a dog trot. I don't know if you know what a dog trot is, but
I don't. No.
It's a larger building with a space that separates it from a smaller building, and they're all roofed with the same roof, so that it looks as if it's a big long rectangle that's actually essentially been pulled apart, and there's a breezeway in between them. And in this house, there's two brothers, and one brother lives in the smaller room, and the other brother lives across the breezeway in the bigger house. And the one brother goes and has dinner with the other brother in his house and in his kitchen. So it's almost like a kind of a granny flat. It's mm-hmm. a sort of a separate little apartment. And it's a direct response to the way that folks live out here. I mean, there's many single mothers living with elderly parents, for example. Many families with different generations all living together. And I think that we do, in the future, need to look at housing that can respond to that. But I think ethically, there's an ethical question. I mean, in the United States of America, there's just a phenomenal luxury of space. And, to just keep on building and keep on building, whether or not it's in suburban small or sprawl or even in rural areas, there may well have to be an end, and we should sort of draw a line in the sand and say this just cannot go on anymore, because we can't afford to pay for the gasoline to connect all of these people together. I think there's a huge, and the United States is going to have to face that ethical dilemma as well, whether or not they can keep building and keep building further away and also keep building more and bigger. And you build a 14,000 square foot house, you've got to heat it and light it and cool it, and that's a big deal.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left here. Again, for anyone who might have just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Andrew Freer. He is associate professor in the School of Architecture at Auburn University. That's in Alabama. And he's also the director of the Rural Studio, which is actually based in New Bern. This is about 3 hours west of Auburn. And this is a program that was came into being in 1993. And the idea was to give architecture students some real hands-on design build experience and at the same time do something for the community. And in that time, they have built a number of structures. They built single-family homes. They have also built things like community centers, and they were involved in a church project in things like playgrounds. He was talking about how just recently the students built an animal shelter. And the idea is to provide comfortable, attractive, energy-efficient, and affordable housing. And in part, they managed to do it because a lot of the labor is donated. The students, of course, do their labor for free. They managed to get a lot of donated materials, and they can manage to build a single-family home for something in the range of $20,000 to $25,000. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line to go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Our guest, by the way, he grew up and was educated in England and has practiced architecture in London and also in Chicago. He taught a design studio for 5 years at University of Illinois at Chicago and then moved on to Alabama. At the end, questions are certainly welcome. People who are listening want to get in here on the conversation. We have a couple of callers here, and we'll get to them. Next up in line is someone in St. Joe, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Fascinated. I have friends in the building trade who are trying to organize under the Wobbly movement. Would they be able to, as builders, get a hold of your design of the $20,000 house and be able, as builders, to offer that kind of service to poor people in this area?
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. I mean, we haven't actually sort of released it for the general public to build it, but I think in the next couple of years, that's our desire. I mean, that again, we're a public entity. There's no secrets here, and, if people like what we've designed, they're more than welcome to take the designs and go off and build them and use them. I mean, that's the point. These are not These are not secrets from anybody. So yeah, if they like those, we'd be more than happy to get them to them.
Well, praise the Lord, brother. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
And then let's go on here too. So at this point, you can't. It sounds like you can't contact you and say, can you send me a set of plans?
Well, we don't. I mean, we're not satisfied with the thing yet to sort of release it to do that. But at the point that we are, I think that that's what we're going to start.
That is what you're moving toward.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, our desire is to help deal with the housing crisis and also to allow people to make some money and get some jobs out of this. So, you know.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Paxton. This is our line 4, somebody on a cell phone. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting program. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I likewise grew up in Chicago. I actually did my graduate work at UIC. And I was wondering if your guest, and I apologize ahead of time because I just tuned in if you talked about it, but I was wondering if you could comment. There's a phenomenon probably not unique to Chicago, but out in the western suburbs, they're doing something called McMansions, where they're knocking down these appear to be perfectly fine homes, and they're putting up these gargantuan models, just enormous homes. Yeah. And it's almost like a competition, you know, one better than the other. Yeah. While in the south side, in the inner city, you have entire blocks of just vacant properties or just properties that have been leveled, where no one is using that property, and yet we're developing more and more outside of the city, more sprawl, more suburbia. Yeah. My concern, my question, I guess, or comment, would be I think the genie's out of the box because this economy is built so much on the housing stock and how many homes can we build and where's the economy going if we don't build homes, that I do agree. I don't think it's sustainable, but I'm afraid that it might be too late in the day for us, and I was wondering if your guest could comment on that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, yeah, I mean, when I lived in Chicago, it was just remarkable for me to go out to the western suburbs and see all of that. I mean, it, you know, Chicago is virtually 100 miles across, and the question is just how much further can it go? He's absolutely right. The economy is, housing is such an important part of the economy, but you have to believe at some point that what are we going to do if the gasoline runs out? I mean, our situation at the moment is simply not sustainable. I mean, I have to tell you, when Hurricane Katrina came through down here in the south, and the gasoline was turned off, and there were armed guards at the gas pumps down here. The strangest thing for me was that there was no questions asked about what happens if the gasoline doesn't come back. What happens if we don't have gasoline? People down here spend their last cent on gasoline. They'd rather buy gasoline than food. And unfortunately, along with that, most of these rural folks have actually forgotten how to grow their own food. And so we pervade this ridiculously unsustainable lifestyle where we build ourselves bigger, we have more air conditioning, we burn more electricity and more gasoline, and at some point something is going to have to give. And it, you know, whether it's the environment, which seems to be sincerely screwed up, or simply the fact that we run out of all of these resources and have to rethink the way we live. I mean, I think we will all probably end up living back in smaller groups or in bigger groups in bigger cities, because I don't know that the rural areas are going to be able to survive, and I think the suburban areas will probably be abandoned. I don't see us being able to sustain it. I mean, it's a doomsday scenario, but I don't, you know, it has to come to an end at some point, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Sorry, that wasn't a very optimistic thing to say, but it, I think it's a tough question.
Well, can you just, if we're talking about, say, go back to the idea of the $20,000 house, could you imagine, I'm sure one could imagine designing a kind of a organization that as a, that would work to build houses like these as a nonprofit.
Yeah.
Maybe you could make that work, but
yeah.
Could you actually, as a building contractor, could you actually make money building $20,000 houses?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. No, I mean, we've had, like I say, they can build one of these houses in 2 weeks, and if you're looking at $10,000 for the labor and the profit, we've had local guys who've talked to us very realistically and soundly about being able to do that. They're very fast. They're very simple. They're not. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to build these. And if we could start building a number of these things right next to each other and do them in, you know, you could even do them in more urban spaces, do them as infills. I think it would make a lot of sense. I mean, to do more of them together is what would, you know, make for good economies of scale. So, you know, it's very difficult to make money when you're just doing the odd one of these because you've got to bring all of your equipment and do that. But if you could do a number of them together, that would make a good deal of sense financially, I think.
Hmm. All right, let's talk with someone next in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I believe your program was involved in using metal containers or shipping containers as homes, and I didn't quite hear anything about this. Maybe I tuned in a little late. But could you address this question and just generally the issue of using metal containers for these for affordable housing?
Yeah.
And I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, actually, it was my school, but it wasn't this program. But I think it was an honorable attempt to. It's one of those things that happens at architecture schools where people see these shipping containers and imagine how cool they would be to sort of set up as a loft space and live in them as a student. Now, personally, I think, quite frankly, the idea of asking people to live in shipping containers is pretty abhorrent, and it certainly wasn't my idea, but I understand why the question was posed, and these things are easy to move around on the back of a truck or on the back of on a railway line, and I think the intentions were honourable. Now, again, would I personally ask myself, or even certainly very poor people, or people that have been disenfranchised or lost their homes, to go and live in these things permanently? I'd be quite honest with you, and I wouldn't expect that. So. But that was done at another part of our university and another part of our school, and I'm not going to be an apologist for that work.
So. All right, let's talk with someone in Bloomington, Illinois, then. Line three. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I saw the display at Auburn at the museum in May of this year.
Great.
Anyway, it's been 6 or 8 months. But I was wondering on the maintenance on that. As I looked at those, I wondered how do you sustain it, and how does that work out, the ongoing maintenance in terms of, you know, the normal stuff that a homeowner does, you know?
Well,
like with the windows, the one where you use the automobile glass.
Yeah. Well, that's a big
wall of glass, which is gorgeous. But I just thought, you know,
absolutely. It's a fantastic question. That particular project is a small community chapel, and it's a classic. It's a project that was done. Goodness, it was done 8 years ago, and ironically enough, we've actually spent this last week helping to repair it because the man who was the sort of the guy in the community who looked after it actually died relatively recently, and it hasn't been upkept, and so. But our students are really encouraged to make very sensible and wise decisions about these community projects, particularly relative to the materials. Originally, the Royal Studio started out being very, very experimental and quite remarkable things with different materials. The problem with those things is that they're so unique that they are hard to maintain. So when you start to do bigger community buildings, you have to be a grown-up and make decisions about materials that perhaps are a little less interesting and less sexy, but will last an awful lot longer and not require painting or cleaning or finishing or refinishing. And that's actually changed the way that the architecture of the rural studio has evolved. You know, the bigger these community projects are, the more responsibility we have. And we're in a place where there's absolutely no money for maintenance, and we accept that. And all of the materials we use, certainly recently, we try to make sure that they're materials that do not need finishing, do not need painting, and do not need continuous care and attention. And I think that project, as an example, was... It's very beautiful, but it was an error to use those particular materials on a project that is publicly owned and is going to have dubious ownership, you know. So it's a great learning process for the students, and as we live out here, if these things begin to deteriorate, we're the ones that have to go back and fix them. And so that, again, is a fantastic learning experience for the students, and hopefully... The second time we fix them, we learn, and we do it right the second time.
We are, I'm sorry to say, at the point where we have to stop, and we have some other callers we simply can't take. If you're interested, by the way, in finding out more about the Rural Studio, you can go to their website. It's the URL is a little long. I think probably the easiest thing to do is go to Auburn University and then go to the Architecture Department.
Or you can just do worldwidewebruralstudio.net.
Oh, all right. Well, then that would make it easier. And then you can see more about it. And in addition, you can take a look at some of the projects that they have been involved with now over the last 14 years or so. To you, Professor Freer, I want to say thanks very much for spending some time with us today.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for all the good questions.
Our guest, Andrew Freer, he is Associate Professor in the School of Architecture. He's also Director of the Rural Studio of Auburn University.